I had somebody ask me one time, they were like, well, how do you find your clients? It's like, I go to interesting places to show up and talk to people. And they're like, what? And I was like, it's amazing how if you show up and talk to people, what can happen? You know, people have all these ideas. The reality is if you show up, you talk to people, you're authentic and be yourself. You work hard and you try and do right by people and do good work, the best that you can. It may not be the best work, but the best that you're able to do. People will appreciate that and you'll find good clients.
Welcome to Tangents by Out of Architecture. Out of Architecture is a career resource network helping designers apply their incredible talents in untraditional ways. We're highlighting some of our favorite stories from the amazing people we've met along the way. We will hear how they created a unique career path for themselves from the wide variety of skills and talents they developed in and out of architecture. Our guest today, William Dodge, is a multidisciplinary designer, design strategist, and conceptual artist based in North Carolina. William shares his wild career journey rooted in being authentic and truly doing his best with each opportunity. I hope after listening, you feel inspired, uplifted, and encouraged to find where your skills and passions meet. Welcome to Tangents. The first question we'd like to get started with is, how would you describe yourself in three words?
Well, I'm a designer, a strategist, and an advocate. I think it's probably the best way. I'm not sure if that's exactly what you're looking for. So I think that's probably the best way to describe me. And I basically, through that lens, I essentially run three different companies that all do very divergent things, but operate with those exact same principles. So I think that's important.
Yeah, I leave that question completely open-ended, so you can answer it however you want. And some people are like thinking about it, and sometimes they're more like more adjectives. But I think if you say that those are the three roles that show up in every aspect, then sounds good.
Yeah, and that's actually just how I live my life too. I had somebody asking me how exactly I ran my business, and I mentioned I was like, I'm always working, but I'm always on vacation at the exact same time. And I would definitely do what I do without getting paid, but don't stop paying me because I really need the money. But yeah, no, I do what I love every day. I don't know if it's either sad or very wonderful, but I live my life like that because I don't ever really turn off my brain. It's like right now I'm in a bit, literally, it sounds bougie because it literally is. I'm in a chateau doing an artist residency in a chateau in France, which is literally the definition of bourgeois. But this is the first time that I've been able to turn my brain off a little bit and just focus on like a thing.
Yeah. And then I'll now ask, what do you do, if you can flesh that out for us? But I generally ask what your background in architecture is, but I think I'd rather hear more about what you do and then maybe just where applicable tie into your background in architecture.
Yeah, it's interesting. From when I was a kid, I grew up in like rural North Carolina, like 50 feet from a tobacco field. And I didn't exactly know what architecture was. I had an opportunity. I befriended my friend Laura Harmon, whose father, Frank Harmon's actually like a really super important, notable architect in Raleigh, North Carolina. He's like a godfather of modernism in the Southeast United States. And I had an opportunity to really experience architecture the first time when I was in like middle school, early high school. And I was always really fascinated by spaces, and I was just really interested in how kind of spaces almost work like storytelling device and allow people to choose their own adventure. And so what I basically did was, I applied several unsuccessful times to get architecture school at NC State. I always say that I applied four times before they let me in, and then they kicked me out twice. And now they ask me for money and to hire their students, which my buddy, the department head, he's like, God, stop telling people that, William. I was like, bro, it's true. And he was like, I know, but you just stop telling people that. But I was always really interested in creating space and thinking about design as kind of a way of living your life and kind of organizing spaces and or organizing any sort of problems, interpersonal relationships, anything. And my background is, I have a master's degree in architecture from NC State. I briefly went to UNC Charlotte. And I also studied architecture at the University of Malta when I was 20. So we'll get kind of into that in a little bit. But until 2 years ago, I was the managing principal of the large architecture office, or basically I had previously when I graduated in 2012, it took me, I don't know, 15 years to finish school. I remember I mentioned I applied 4 times and then they kicked me out twice, and so long and incredibly unillustrious road. I was certainly not the best student, but I asked the most questions. Maybe that's why they kicked me out. But yeah, so when I graduated in 2012, there's nobody hiring. So I applied over 300 jobs. And I actually got my only job offer was in architecture and was at a small firm in Idaho Falls, Idaho. And they offered me a job as a project manager, first of all, which is a terrible idea. I'm like the least detail oriented person about certain things because I get really like specific about certain details. But in general, I've got 2 folders on my computer that say clean up. And then there's a second folder that says clean up too, where I just drag everything into a folder. I'm like incredibly disorganized, which is amazing that people trust me in making projects, but I actually do a really good job. I'm really good at what I do. But there were the only people that would call me back. And I remember they offered me this job and they said, pack your family in the car and come out here. And I was like, well, you know, I really want to fly out there and see it. I said, yeah, there's no money for that. And I was like, what? And they said, yeah, there's no money for that. Either do you want the job or not? I got 100 other people that want this job if you don't want it. It's literally the only job in America. And I remember thinking I can't move my 14-year-old stepdaughter to the middle of Idaho without going at least to see it. So I turned it down and ended up getting a job that changed my life forever. It was a janitor at NC State Libraries with a master's degree in architecture and some award-winning research, making $9 an hour. But had I not taken that job, I would certainly not be where I am now. So it's pretty interesting. But through a long string of events, I ended up working on some of the wayfinding at Hunt Library. So I ended up working at NC State Libraries as a janitor. And it turned out I could do more than that. And they figured that out. And I helped them with some of the wayfinding, helped set up one of the first academic makerspaces in America. Because I spent a lot of time in the shop when I was in grad school. Just did a lot of really kind of multidisciplinary design stuff, which I really like to do. But there was a state hiring freeze with the state. So it was only a temporary employee. And I ended up managing to find a job in manufacturing. I should mention too, I've actually never gotten a job that I've ever actually applied for in my entire life. Like there's nice. Like my girlfriend and all these other people that I know, they're like, every job. I'm like, bro, I've never gotten a single job. I mean, like not even like UPS, nothing. People are like train wrecked. So I don't know exactly what it is, but I've essentially created all of my own roles my entire career and ended up meeting a manufacturer in the height of the recession who had the pictures of steel being erected all over. And they were at the engineering career fair and I went up to them and started talking to them and they were saying, this is really interesting. You seem interesting. Let's talk. And I handed them my resume and they said, we don't hire architects. And it was like, good news for you, bro. I don't have my license. It's the way in business. And then I said, do you call an architect? And he said, yeah, there are clients. And I said, well, if you ever want to get in doors you could never in a million years otherwise get into, you give me a call. And they happened to call me a year later. So I ended up going into manufacturing, calling on architects. So I got to see behind the curtain of who was cool, who was not, who valued their employees, who didn't, who treated people who didn't, who valued my time, who didn't, et cetera. And so it was really pretty interesting. So going all around the country in some of the top offices and offices people had never heard of and seeing what worked and what didn't and meeting a lot of really cool people along the way. Fast forward with a couple of different stops, I had actually saw a job that I thought would be a good fit. It was for a national higher or for a regional higher education leader for the Southeast United States for a major practice. And I applied for it. I was like, oh man, perfect. Who's going to know more about higher education than I am? It took me 15 years to graduate. This is like perfect. I've seen it all. So I applied for this job and I immediately got a rejection letter because I wasn't licensed. So fast forward 6 months later, somebody called me and they said, it was a recruiter. They said, there's this job. It's perfect for you. And it's like, well, what's the job? And they told me and I immediately recognized it was a job that I already applied for. And I knew that they weren't going to give me the job. So I just threw some ridiculous number on. Basically added 50% to what I would have taken if they had offered the job originally and they hired me for that number. So they had rejected me originally and then they paid a recruiter tens of thousands of dollars to go and hire me for 50% more than what I would have taken had I gotten that job originally.
You have the best luck.
Well, I kind of found myself in a situation where I put myself in positions to be lucky. And I put myself out there a lot. I don't really get beat up by rejection. As I mentioned, the 300 jobs I applied for. And that's actually one thing we were talking about last night. It's residency. It's for whatever jobs and risks you don't take, you immediately fail in those things because you're not even trying. But what's the worst that's going to happen? Somebody's going to tell you no, or going to not take your call or return your email. So what? By not reaching out, you've already answered that question to begin with. So after I was working for this practice for a while, we were doing really good work in spite of the firm that I was with, not necessarily because of the firm I was with. I decided I was going to leave. 2016 also rolled around, and I was really pretty interested in getting out of the country. And I'll get to that part in a minute because it all comes full circle. So I started interviewing with different firms around the world and met with a firm in New Zealand, another firm in Italy, various practices in Malta, and just because I used to live there. And it turned out at the time, just the logistically for family reasons, I wasn't able to move, but I stayed in touch with those people. And I work with many of those people now as my clients, which is actually pretty interesting. And I wouldn't have even known them had I not applied for these jobs, et cetera. But at the time, I was thinking about moving overseas. Oddly enough, one of my manufacturing clients became the CEO of a major architecture firm. And he asked me, he was like, hey, we've previously had an office in North Carolina. It's failed. There's basically no one there. It's essentially closed. We had an office there for 5 years. They never won a single project. You should consider coming. I was like, I don't know, man. I'm thinking about moving overseas. I might start my own practice. And he actually had a really good line. He said, well, you should start your practice. And you should name it, insert the name of his firm there, and I'll pay for everything. And so basically gave me the opportunity, trusting me enough to start basically a brand new office and treat it as my practice with his money. And in order to do that, I recruited another one of my former manufacturing clients to come and be my co-managing partner. And between the two of us, we radically transformed the portfolio of the practice, hired new people, won pretty exceptional work, and ultimately went from having zero projects to over $2 billion worth of work when I left in less than 49 months, which is pretty crazy. And that's not necessarily because of me or because of us, but because of certain things that we put into place. I was very adamant that if I was going to join, and this is how I live my life, I'm never working for anybody again in my life. I work with people and have people work with me, not for me. And I needed a blank checkbook to hire whoever I wanted. And we were going to lose money in spectacular fashion for 24 to 36 months, like plagues, locusts, like biblical stuff. And after that, dump trucks full of money, we're going to start showing up. And that's exactly what happened. Because a lot of firms, a lot of times, what they'll do is this, they'll say, oh, we're going to win this project and then we can hire these people. But the truth is, when you do it that way, you're never hiring the right people. You're never hiring at the right time. And so what we did was, is we convinced our firm to be able to invest in us ahead of time. And we hired all the best people, built this really incredible culture where all the best people wanted to work. And then all the best clients wanted to work with the best people. And we built one of the best firms in the United States, like overnight, basically. And so after that, this is a really long, and it's called Tangents for a reason, but
keep going.
It's a really long story, but basically through my time, I was the national higher education leader for academic spaces for this particular firm and helped to run the office. We later were fortunate enough to convince some other good buddies of ours that were great at operations and managing people and all that stuff to come along and really manage that kind of stuff. But I would always see these opportunities that weren't necessarily the right fit for us, but they were the right fit for other people that I knew. And so like, oh, XYZ project is happening. Well, that's not the right fit for me, but Ryan should talk to Peter and they should pursue this project and they should put this landscape architect on the team because this university loves that landscape architect or whatever it is, right? And they go and win a $100 million project or a, you know, big deal master plan with a $5 million or whatever it is. And so basically, not even including my own firm, I figured out that I probably put, I don't know, close to $10 million in net fees into other people's firms. And which is great. I was just trying to do it to help people out because I saw a need and I can connect the dots for people to be successful. And that's what I do for a living. I've done it my whole life. But at the end of the day, I graduated with 6 figures in student loans. I still have student loans paid, and I love working with other people and bigger companies, et cetera. It's great. But at the end of the day, I really just decided that my usefulness, it's not that I wasn't so useful, but I had my impact in that firm was essentially vertical the first 4 years. I could have been there the next 50 years and not had a tenth of the impact that I had the first four. And so what I've done my entire career is every 3 to 4 years, I find a new job, not because it's not fulfilling anymore. It's just, they don't need me. I've done what I've been there to do. So instead, what I decided to do was, instead of making other people millions of dollars and getting paid a salary, what I decided to do was, I was going to go out on my own and figure out a way to monetize that, but also, and still be able to connect the dots for people to be successful, but be able to pick and choose my clients. I went out on my own and started my own practice, come public 2 years ago. And to my, with a pretty radical goal, sounds ridiculous, but it is a pretty radical thought. It's like, to be able to do the best work I can, the people, with wonderful people that I love, have fun, make a difference, and get paid my value. That shouldn't be a radical thing. It totally is in our industry. And so instead of being able to go and charge some ridiculous amount of money for my expertise, which is, I've got a really pretty extensive knowledge and network of people. And instead of going and saying, somebody asking what I charge by the hour, I actually don't charge by the hour. I charge on retainer, and which is really unusual for architecture. But basically the way I look at this is, I'm an on-contract part-time senior partner to different firms around the world. And I work on retainer. People don't need me until they need me, but when they need me, they really need me. And if I can make somebody $1 million working 100 hours a week, that's one thing. If I can make somebody $1 million with a quick phone call, it doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. It's the same result. Right. It's not about time and billable hours, all of that. So it seems preposterous. And so what I decided to do is take my rate, what I felt like I needed to make, break it down in a kind of a digestible format. So I work with different practices that don't compete with one another, whether they're in New Zealand or Malta or Philadelphia or wherever it is. And basically my rate is my rate. So there's no multiplier on it. When you have an employee, so you have a $50,000 employee, well, that costs the company close to $100,000, if not more, to employ that person. If somebody's paying me XYZ a month, that's my rate. There's no multiplier on that, right? And so what I do is propose, this is a digestible rate. You can have all of my network, access to my portfolio, access to my insight, strategy, thought process, or essentially what it costs you to employ a mid-level employee. And so what I do is, and then I work with multiple different clients and I aggregate my cost of multiple, literally nations in the areas in the world. And then that way I'm able to get paid by value, work with cool people, connect dots for other people to be successful, et cetera. And originally I thought I really needed to limit my client base and spend X number of time working with each one. And I actually had a client about 6 months after I started. He said, honestly, don't worry about doing that, man. We need you when we need you. We don't need you to manufacture stuff to do to fill up your time. And he was like, and if anything, he's like, actually you having more clients is actually beneficial to all of us, because then we know more what's going on around the world and in different markets, as opposed to just being super siloed in our specific region or market, which is really interesting. It's been 2 years of starting your own business. Is both deeply exciting and scary as hell. It's like finding out that you have the opportunity to go to the moon. It's like really exciting, but I was like, it's a disaster could strike, but if you make it, it'll be worth it. And even if you're not, damn, at least you tried. And that's kind of like my mentality on life. What's the worst that's going to happen? At least to me, the worst that's going to happen is me sitting on my deathbed when I'm old or I'm dying of some disease, wishing I'd lived my life a different way. Really yeah. Long rambling.
No, I think that's actually part of Tangents, is that like sharing everyone's unique career journeys, the thoughts they had along the way, and those unique experiences can help other people who might share that some part of that journey.
Yeah. And I will say too, there's actually a really interesting little moment, not only about when I was working at NC State Library. So actually, I should have mentioned that there was an opportunity that I had before that at NC State Libraries where they were looking for an exhibit design consultant, and I applied for it and I was so excited for it. I was like, this is going to be amazing. I love making stuff. I love doing exhibit design. And I hit it off with the hiring person. And I was like, this is going to be great. I thought she was going to give me the job, and she called and she just, hey, William, we love you, man. We really want to hire you, but the side of it, I really need just more, some more graphic design help. So we're going to hire somebody else. Turns out he's a friend of yours. And I was like, oh man, that's really a bummer. But Lincoln Hancock, oh, he's an amazing guy. He's a great designer. And so I was like really devastated, but happy for my buddy. Well, she calls me back a couple of weeks later. I was like, good news, bad news. Bad news is I'm screwed because I don't have enough help. Good news is that now I need more help and I can pay you more so I can hire you as a contractor. But you just basically have to bill me at the end of the project to help me with some exhibit design. So I was basically a part-time contractor to help with this project. Well, I was doing all kinds of other stuff. I was working, there's a music festival in North Carolina called Hopscotch, and I used to run all the outside bars for Hopscotch. And I remember we had a deadline. The exhibition had to be open, so the board of trustees were coming the next morning. Well, I was also running the bars for Hopscotch and Modest Mouse and Flaming Lips, and I think Public Enemy were playing. And you know, it's like, up 10,000 people are coming to this show. I've got to leave. And I remember walking out the door, and my boss was like crying, and she goes, "This is going to be a disaster. I'm going to get fired if we don't get this done." And I told her, I said, "I'll be back. The library's open 24 hours, right?" She said, "Yeah." I said, "I'll be back." And so I left and went and worked the show, and I came back at 3:30 in the morning, exhausted, and we just powered through and we got the exhibition. I remember when the assistant university librarian came in and he was like, "Man," he was like, "This is like amazing. I can't believe you guys got it done." And I said, "Yeah, we needed to get done, so we got it done." And he goes, "You're still wearing the same clothes you wore yesterday." And I said, "Yeah, you know, I was working and running these bars at this music festival." And he was like, "Interesting." And he was like, "Man, you really saved us. I can't thank you enough. I'll see you on Monday." And I said, "Well, actually, you won't see me on Monday because my contract ends now." And he said, "Well, I have a job for you if you're interested." And I said, "What's that?" I said, "No, I said, I'll take it." And he goes, "Don't you want to hear what it is first?" I said, "I don't care." And he said, "It's a facilities maintenance technician." I was like, "Sounds great." He goes, "You know what that is?" I was like, "No idea. It's a janitor. I paid $9 an hour, but it's something." And I said, "Sounds great. Sign me up." And so that's how I ended up working at NC State Libraries. And I told you the rest earlier. Well, fast forward, when I was working at this one farm in Raleigh that we were growing our practice from scratch. This farm had previously been known for higher education, like student housing and master planning. They've never really done libraries or any sort of academic building or civic buildings or whatever. And the first project we ended up doing was a corn maze, a modernist corn maze at the North Carolina Museum of Art, in partnership with my old boss from NC State Libraries who was crying to be kind of staged to do. And so she and I were the two artists on this exhibition, North Carolina Museum of Art. And my old firm was the architect of record on a corn maze, which is hilarious. So see young designers doing section models of corn maze and all this stuff. It's actually pretty hilarious. Well, anyway, so that project actually started to get some regional press, and people at our firm are really curious about what are these people in Raleigh doing? We don't do that. We do student housing. Don't they know that? And so we've started to really kind of rapidly transform the portfolio also too. It was a building master plan or part of the NC State Libraries, which is the gold standard nationally, or actually internationally, for academic libraries. So we applied for this project, my buddy Jesse and I, and we were using all our personal images and previous experience, like the wayfinding maps in our library, whatever, the corn maze that we were doing in partnership with the lead designer of NC State Libraries. So we go and we interview for this project, and we kill the interview. It's great. At the end of the interview, the university decided pretty much that they were going to go in a different direction with the selection. It's a really good firm, to another really good firm. And the university librarian stood up and said, "No, we're going to hire this firm because I trust William, because William stayed all night to make sure that my exhibition got done. And I promised you that they will do the best job." Because at that time, Greg had gone from being the assistant university librarian to the vice provost at the university and the university librarian. And he knew that I would do everything I could to help them out on the project. And it was that single project that transformed our portfolio, because then all of a sudden we had a project with the gold standard for academic libraries that we could shop around the country. And so we started doing libraries all over New Orleans, Iowa State, all these other places that allowed our firm to continue to grow. And we would have never done that if I hadn't come back from working all night at the bar to make sure that their exhibition was open. And had I not taken the janitor job, I would have never been in that situation. Very, very long and random string of events. But I guess, as I mentioned, I always try and put myself in situations to be able to help people in an authentic way, not a self-serving way, just because that's how I was raised, to try and do the best work I can with the best people, have fun, make a difference. And that's how I've tried to build my practices. That's how I've tried to set work culture everywhere I've worked. And we always try to be a mentor, as I've certainly had really amazing, incredible people mentor me. and in create kind of an atmosphere of constant growth and hustle too, because things in life aren't given to us. And I think we can get complacent really easily. And I feel like our industry has gotten super complacent, and I think it's profoundly broken. I remember when I left my previous firm, that was like a really wonderful conversation. I mean, the CEO gave me a hug, told me he loved me, and he'd do everything he could to help me move forward, which meant a lot to me. That firm probably would have gone bankrupt if we had not started that office, because with COVID, all higher education stopped, and we had started to diversify and get into life science and brought in all these other people. We actually exploded during the pandemic, where everybody else was laying people off, and we would have never stayed in business if they had stayed in with their traditional business model. But I remember when I was leaving, he said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "I don't want to be an architect, man." And he said, "Well, what do you want to do?" And I said, "I just want to do really incredible architecture." It was a big difference. And he started laughing. He said, "That's actually, that's a great quote." And I said, "Yeah, it is, but it's also a really good point. Most architects don't actually really get a chance to get involved in changing people's lives in the way that we imagine that architects can and do. And I feel like most people in America, at least, become more facilitators of buildings rather than truly like great builders of space and community, which I feel like that's what architecture is lacking globally, but in particular in the US.
There were a lot of different qualities of your character, your personality, that I think you can strongly connect to the different points in your journey. Like the way you said, you want to be really authentic and do your best, and the hustle that comes through really strongly. I could ask you, what is an example of a project or a client that you've worked with that is like a favorite example? But I imagine that they might all be very different from one another. So
yeah, if they are. Actually, I think my favorite example, maybe the example I just gave you about how when I was a janitor, it turned into one of being that ultimately set in motion a series of events that helped transform a portfolio for a nationally recognized firm. Yeah, so I think that may be a really great example. But I actually, too, I would say I've got a multiple different practices. I should say I've got a strategy and design practice public, which I'd mentioned. And then I have a public art firm called A Gang of Three with two buddies, one of which is a landscape architect who is one of the best landscape architects in the country. It's Will Belcher. He has a firm called Ground Control. They're really fantastic. You should check them out if you don't know them. But they're doing really amazing work with some of the top architects globally all over. And I met him through my previous experience pursuing work and or putting him on teams for said projects for other people, because he was really the best fit to be on the team and help win a project, et cetera. And oddly enough, the other person who from Gang of Three, who we became really good friends during our time working together at NC State Libraries, when he got the job that I didn't, when I had applied for the exhibit design consultant, is my buddy Mike Hancock. So he ultimately ended up getting the job, which put me in a situation where I didn't have a job after the exhibition, et cetera, which led to the janitor and all that stuff. So the three of us have a practice called A Gang of Three. We started doing public art that kind of really operates in a weird kind of gradient of space between public art, landscape architecture, installation, urban design, and planning. It's not really any of those things, but all of those things at the exact same time. And so it was different than what it was when I started public, because I intentionally started my strategy practice because I saw a hole in the market and there was no one in the world that was doing what I do, which is really great from a standpoint of you have no competitors, but it's also really challenging because you have no competitors and nobody understands what you did. With A Gang of Three, we had started basically due to the fact that all of us had been involved in large scale projects that had public art on them, or we'd been involved in selection committees or planning committees or whatever. And we had seen kind of some of the quality of difference on public art submittals. And we noticed that they were very much object based. Here's my thing. Here's my statue of a bronze eagle or old dead white guy or whatever it is. And that's just not at all what we were interested in. And so what we did was very place focused. A research-based public art, which I think really resonates with people, allows people to choose their own adventure within the space and have their own experience with it. Kind of what I always try to do with architecture and design. But the interesting thing about that is while public was intentionally designed to meet a need that didn't exist globally, we did not intend to start a public art practice that had no competitor. But because of what the way that we approach things. We have no competitors. What that means is we're not right for every project, but the projects we're right for, we're really right for, right? And you had asked me about one of my favorite projects is our first project we ever won as a gang of three was for a floodplains educational project for the city of Raleigh. The city couldn't call it public art because they didn't want the conservative people to get upset that a lot of floodplain money was being spent on some fancy art piece. And so we were hired essentially to look at 2 acres of land in Crabtree Valley in the city of Raleigh, which there's a mall that was built there in the early 70s. And after they built the mall there, it basically caused ecological devastation of untold proportions. There are neighborhoods around there that no longer exist because of flooding that has occurred. People have died. It's horrific. Oddly enough, one of my childhood friends drowned as a result of flooding at Crabtree Creek when I was in high school in the aftermath of Hurricane Fran. And I had three other friends that were there with him, and one of them almost drowned, and somebody tire broke on the waist and diving to save my friend Luke. Later on, after we won this project, we hired to work with the project on us, and we finished it on the 25th anniversary of our friend's death, which was really heavy. But we were given $50,000 for 2 acres. That basically works out to be about 56 cents in a square foot. You can imagine what you can do with that. But what we decided to do, we were all kind of brainstorming about it. And normally we don't like to come to projects with preconceived notions of what things should be. But being that we were so familiar with the site, we had such a strong personal history with it. Both Lincoln and I only lived less than a mile from there, and I'm very familiar with it. And due to the budget constraints, we just knew that there was only one. The only thing we could come up with was basically trying to educate people on the floodwaters and how dangerous they can be. There's flash flood, it's not just hurricane. And so what we decided to do was do color-coded flagpoles. Essentially, they're not actually flagpoles, they're actually much nicer, but the concept is there. They've got flagpoles and cap them off at each top of each storm and have multiple for each storm. So when you stand next to one and it's 25 feet tall and you go, God damn, that's tall, you experience it one way. But then when your eye drops and you see all the corresponding ones that are same color code, your eye draws an invisible line between them and you situate yourself underwater. All right. So what we did was through that, we were able to do 25 markers as well as there's an underpass also as part of the project. We always knew we were going to do something there under the underpass in terms of data or whatever. And so what we essentially try to do is come up with a system that named the storms and talked about the dates and the data, but almost in like a little Orphan Annie secret decoder ring type way, where you had to spend some time with it to understand what it was. And you couldn't understand it without understanding the flood markers, and you couldn't understand the flood markers without understanding it. So you really had to spend some time. And there was a landscape element too, where with a reinstituted native meadow that we invited the public to come and reseed and plant. So in 5, 10, 15, 20 years later, when these little kids that were out there planting it will drive by and feel a sense of ownership. So anyway, we were able to do that project, finish the project. It floods all the time. To the best of our knowledge, it's one of, if not the only project of its kind and globally. But there are projects that are designed to flood, like spiral jetty floods on the Great Salt Lake. But that's more of a gradual thing. This will be like people will be walking there one day and the next day it will be under 20 feet of water. Like it's a pretty wild thing, depending on what the weather patterns are, et cetera. And as I mentioned, we were able to partner with our friend Luke, who had a very personal situation going on because he himself almost drowned as a result to these and would have had it not been for a bystander being there. So we ended up finishing that project, 50 cents a square foot, ended up winning an AIA North Carolina Merit Awards, won 2 American Planning Association Awards, won the City of Raleigh Medal of Arts, which is typically a lifetime achievement award, but it's never been given to a project before ours in 40 years that was awarded that. And was nominated for International Public Art Prize. And then actually we just found out that Google just gave us an award that's not officially announced until probably Friday, but by the time it will officially come out, Google Earth does an awards program where they seek out projects that are seeking to do environmental or social good using their systems. It's called the Global Impact Geo for Good Award. And then Architects Newspaper named our project to editor's pick for best landscape project in America, which is a $50,000 project, which is cool because here in Timberlake's Paulson Center, which is a super badass building, by the way, it was on, and my friend Richard designed it. It's amazing. But that's a $2 billion project or something like that. And it's on the same list. And then we see OMA's museum. It's on the same list. Our project's 56 cents a square foot. And I think that actually goes back to all the things I was talking about earlier about being authentic, hustling, trying to figure out a way to reimagine how things could be. A lot of times people think that great design has to cost more money. It doesn't. There's a lot you can do with just kind of creative thinking, light, shadow, and really mundane materials, but it's how you use them. And I feel like that is the case when it comes to your career too. It's not like you don't necessarily have to go to the fanciest school or anything like that. It's really how, it's really what you do with what you have. And we just like we try to put ourselves in situations to be able to do the best we can for our communities and be conscious and be good people and do good work and make the work attainable. I think that's one of the biggest problems in design is we think of design as a luxury. It really honestly should be a right. And I'm not like hating on the American system, but and it happens everywhere, by the way. You can go to the most beautiful place on the earth and somebody bets you about how terrible it is. But, you know, and in the United States in particular, we really think about quantity, not quality. And I think that's something that's really holding our industry back. But oh my man, again, I never really wanted to be an architect. I really wanted to do really incredible architecture. And it's funny, actually, I should mention when, I'm not sure if you'll leave this on and take it out, but when I started seeing my girlfriend, she was like, oh, my father's an architect. He was like a big deal architect at Albert Kahn in Detroit. And he's amazing. He's really wonderful. And he had one rule, and it was like, you will not become, nor will you date or get involved with an architect. And so when I quit my job to go out on my own, she said, congratulations, Dad. Now your greatest fears have come true. I'm now dating an unemployed architect. And I said, correction, unemployed pretend architect. There's a difference. Yeah, it's interesting, but it's all about your perspective. I think it's just kind of, that's how I live my life, is framing perspectives and also reframing them, both my own and other people, and how to do more with less. And I should also mention, in terms of in the same strategies in which we did this $50,000 project, doing more with less, I was able to help one of my clients through my retainer from a strategy standpoint end up winning a $50 million project in a market in which they didn't operate through our situation. It was a higher education project, and they had some, but it was more like community college stuff. And this is a really high profile academic building at a major research institution that they would have never won it without me, and I would have never won it without them. But it was creating the dots for people to be successful and being able to see the strategy, to set the perfect strategy. And just that project alone is worth my retainer times 10. And they were like, that was in the first 6-7 months of being on contract with him. Oh my God, why would we not do this? And I remember when I made the pitch to them originally, the CEO looked at me and he was like, I've never heard of anything like this before. And I was like, yeah, it makes sense if you think about it. There are other industries that do something like this. And he was like, William, I got to ask you a last question. And I was like, what? He's like, you talk like an idiot. And I was like, what? And he's like, why in the hell would I not hire you? I was like, exactly. I wasn't sure that this was going that direction, but that is the right answer. And yeah, and it's funny, when I gave him my retainer, they were like, yeah, it's great. You should ask for more money next time. I said, well, you can pay me. No, man. We've already come to an agreement. You just think about that for your other clients maybe before. But yeah, my entire career, whether it's as kind of principal at a firm or in my own firms or with my own clients or with projects, with direct or indirect clients, like, you know, somebody's paying me or the community and people that are going to experience it. How do you create this in life? How do you create a situation where there's no winners and losers, but everybody wins? And like in our industry in particular, and you guys focus on that pretty regularly, it's, you know, a lot of these people become super wealthy who own these firms on the sweat and the backs of young design staff that they work indiscriminately and just abuse. I'm super not interested in being a part of that process. And it's like, how can we create a situation where people get paid the value and really feel like they can grow? And when it's time for them to move on, we're happy for them. We're not upset that they're leaving us. It's like, when I have really great design staff working with me, I hope that they're going to move on, because the last thing I want them to do is sit around 20 years from now and be in the same position that they're in now. Because God, that's the worst nightmare for myself. And I wouldn't be doing my job if I wasn't encouraging them to explore other things.
What do you think helps stick people from their hesitations or to take chances, both your clients or people that are trying to pursue their own things? I feel like the architecture industry very much wants to tread very carefully when they make moves a lot of times, and then nothing happens.
Yeah, I mean, I think for architecture, inherently, we like to think of ourselves as an industry that's like innovative and like creative and all this stuff. Bullshit. They're like bankers and lawyers are significantly more innovative than architects when it comes to doing business. Like the way we bill out, the way we write contracts, the way we've given up all our power and cower and fear and liability. I blame the AI for a lot of that. Also, just the system, the way that we continue to perpetuate that. We try and talk about diversity and we show really diverse faces when we show architecture, but that's total lip service. We really need to be doing more to try and get people involved in the community from all aspects. I used to be on the ACE Mentors board and was a mentor for years. And it's funny, I was the anti-architecture mentor. Actually, I would tell everybody, whatever we do, don't do this. And I started doing it when I was in manufacturing and continued to do that when I went into private practice. And you'd be amazed at how many people have come up to me and be like, I know who you are. And you're like, you told me not to be an architect. And I was like, really? And like, I thought you were the biggest jerk. And like, God damn, I should have listened to that guy. He was to help me out. And or I have friends, my friend Claire Hsu, who actually recommended that I come to this residency. She was interviewed by Madam Architect a couple of years ago. She works at Sanders Place. She's amazing. I've known her since she was like 14. And I tried to tell her to not become an architect. You know? And she was like, bro, that just made me want to do it more. That's like saying, you will not see this boy. You will never see that boy again. Like tell your teenage daughter that, of course, they're just going to want to do it more. When it worked out really well for her, she's amazing. And she's the one who actually drew the sections of the corn maze, by the way, which whenever she interviews for a new job, everybody wants to talk to her about that because it's so weird. They just can't even understand what's going on. But yeah, in terms of architecture and in life, I think it's just fear. I was fortunate when I was starting my practice, I didn't have anybody else to worry about. My stepdaughter's 26 and I wasn't married anymore. And I had the opportunity where I didn't have anybody else counting on me. But one thing I've learned in life is that if there's anyone I can count on, it's myself. Not to say that I'm going to be successful all the time, but I'm going to die trying. Like if I set my mind to something. And that's all you can really ask of yourself is if you're willing to take that risk. And again, like I said, I was in a really unique situation where if I failed, it was entirely on me. It wasn't ruining generations of people, but it was still really hard for me. I had gotten really sick in 2021. My ex and I were still very close and she had COVID and I was sure, I had COVID, but I was like hallucinating and I was stuck in bed for 2 weeks and I'd started seeing a woman because now my partner, my girlfriend, but Amelia is amazing. And I told Amelia, I was like, I feel right. And I ended up going to the doctor and I did a chest CT or chest x-ray and they found something on my lungs. And then the next day they said, we found something on your lungs. We need to do a chest CT. And so they did that. And they called me on Friday and they said the pulmonologist has rearranged their schedule on Monday. They need to meet with me first thing Monday morning. We think you have lung cancer. Yeah, heavy. So I remember thinking there are a few things. I'm not afraid to die. I am worried about who's going to have to handle all my stuff because I've got an insane amount of, I've been collecting art my whole life. I just have just random little knickknacks and stuff. And I hate the thought of like my stepdaughter or somebody having to get burdened with that. But my biggest regret was never having the guts to start my own practice. And which is really interesting because I thought I would be like afraid to die or something like that. That wasn't it at all. It was really just feeling a missed opportunity. And I went to the pulmonologist and I said, good news, bad news. You don't have lung cancer, but your pneumonia's so bad, it's a miracle you're not dead. We can't believe that you're like walking around. And so by the time I were in, they treated me and 6 months later, I recovered. And by that time, I had already made a plan to start my own practice because I was not going to live somebody else's dream anymore. And, you know, I like making other people money just as well as I like doing other projects, but I need to be paid accordingly. And then that way, I'm also able to volunteer my time. I should mention, I do a lot of pro bono work because I get paid
like a living wage through my other stuff. So I get an opportunity to give back to my community and other things, which I think is important. And it's something our industry doesn't do enough of. But when I had to tell my firm that I was leaving, it was really tough because we had hired over 40 people in the 4 years I was there. Many of those people, most of those people were either former classmates or colleagues of mine, or they were my clients when I was in manufacturing that I had convinced to leave their very comfortable jobs to join me, including one friend who was in his 60s and he'd only ever worked at one practice in his entire life. That was tough. But also at the end of the day, like everybody was really appreciative of kind of the opportunity that I'd given them, probably because it was time that I almost died, but really creating an opportunity for people to be successful and giving them a chance to thrive. And I remember having those conversations with my friends that joined me, and they were like, William, you got to go do your own thing, man. We would be holding you back if you didn't. And it's interesting how many people told me that they didn't realize that they were in an abusive relationship with their previous firms, and they just didn't realize it. And then they got out, and then they were really able to understand what normalcy could look like. And I like to think that firm is still that way. I'm not sure if it is or not. I get the feeling that they've continued to grow, and I think they've lost a little bit of that, I don't know, that kind of family, small studio. I mean, when I say family, I don't mean like the corporate, like you're our family. I mean, like we all like play trivia together and take pottery classes, and they're like my kids or like my brother, dad, and genuinely love each other. And that's the way life should be. Life's too short to work with assholes. I don't know if that helps, but I think there's a serious element of fear. But again, what's the worst that's going to happen? Like to me, the worst that's going to happen is being regretful when I'm old or laying on my deathbed wishing I had done something different, because I've done that. It sucks.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing all of that. And that's a great reminder. Just what would you really regret? And it's hard because when I feel like people get so dedicated with their projects, their work, they throw everything of themselves in it. But then like weeks go by, months go by, and you did a great project for your company, that like for the client. And it's like, you could be proud of it, but also you spent a lot of of your life and time on that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You only have so much personal and professional capital to use up. I mean, think about a battery. How much energy do you want to spend on certain things, and for other people versus yourself, versus your family? It's a balance. Unfortunate that I was able to recognize that before the end of my life. And you know, you hear all these interviews with palliative care doctors and stuff, you know, all the things are, it's, I wish I had traveled more. I wish I had been more involved in my kid's life. I wish I had taken this risk. It's like, why not just do those things, man? And I'm an artist residency in France right now, specifically focused on public art. And that's the kind of thing that a lot of people wait till they're 40, 50 years in their career. And they're like, okay, I'm going to retire. I'm going to go do this now. It's like, why not do that when you have the chance to really enjoy it? And I should mention that actually, so I'm helping teach a class. My friend Sandra Valentino is the main professor, and he's amazing. He's won World Architecture. Their firm, Valentino Architects, has won a World Architecture Award, and he's on the jury for the Architecture Review and all this stuff. He's a super rock star. But he's a Maltese architect that I've become friends with, and we work together. And I was at a dinner party and a rooftop party at 3 a.m. in Malta. And I ended up, because this is how I generate business. This is how I live my life. I'm just as likely to meet a client, potential client at a bar in Guadalajara, Mexico. I'm sitting around my hometown. It's just people that are doing interesting things. You got to go and get out there. You can't wait for them. And so I was at this party and then ended up meeting somebody from an Italian NGO that specifically works with migrants. And so we started talking about the Mediterranean migrant crisis and, you know, what are there some potential design situations that might be able to help some of these things. And I mentioned it to my buddy Sandro, and he teaches a class every year that we basically decided to make that the student project to reevaluate the whole system and framework involved about like how migrant camps happen, how there can be job training and kind of creating this system for people to be successful, and not necessarily creating an internship situation or an internment camp, right? It's like, how can we use design strategies to create a better life for these people that have already been through such a horrific experience. And so we were teaching this class the last semester, and actually we're trying to do a public art project that's calling attention to that kind of really radically needed subject to be talked about. But that is all pro bono, and all that stuff's funded through his architecture work, and my work is doing strategy. And it's like, how can we spend time as designers to start thinking about things like that? But for me, I had somebody ask me one time, they were like, well, how do you find your clients? It's like, I go to interesting places and show up and talk to people. And they're like, what? And I was like, it's amazing how if you show up and talk to people, what can happen? You know, people have all these ideas. They're like, well, what's your business plan? And I can make a plan. It's not going to be real. By the time we get a couple of months into it, it's going to have changed radically. You know, I could make a smart ass and say my business plan is to find a giant sack of money in the red, but I don't think that's going to work out. But it's just as likely as me making a more detailed business plan too, is what the reality is. If you show up, you talk to people, you're authentic and be yourself, you work hard and you try and do right by people and do good work the best that you can. It may not be the best work, but the best that you're able to do. People will appreciate that and you'll find good clients. I gave this lecture at Clemson once and I always said, you know, always be yourself no matter what, unless you're an asshole, and then don't be yourself, because I think that's important. But I do think authenticity is really important, because people are going to find out eventually. And I'm not saying you need to, that people hide their true selves from their clients, but a lot of times that people are worried that what people might judge them or whatever, but I feel like they're not necessarily authentic to themselves. And I think that's really something that we need to do a better job trying to give permission to people to fail, because that's not the end of the world. We're of this mindset in America, the participation trophies and all that stuff. It's okay to fail. It's okay to not be the best. But actually, I've got a really interesting story. My girlfriend, she was an All-American swimmer at Wisconsin when she was in school. And she had a roommate who was pretty good swimmer, but she was certainly not one of the best swimmers. And she was like the backup to the backup to the backup. Gwen Jorgensen's her name. And she was like that on the Wisconsin swimming team and the Wisconsin track team. She was never the starter. She would only go if something like basically everybody else got in a bus wreck or something. And she would fill in the wing. But no, I'm joking. She was still pretty good, but she was certainly not one of the rock stars. So fast forward, and they graduate. And this woman, Gwen, she was working at Ernst & Young. She was like 25, 26 years old. And she's like a CPA, that she gets a call from the U.S. Olympic Committee. And they say, this is Gwen Jorgensen. She said, yeah. And they said, oh, well, you know, this is so-and-so from the U.S. Olympic Committee. You know, she's like, I'm not the one you want to talk to. And she's like, I don't know if you know this. I was not the best. There was like 20 other swimmers on the team that did it. And they were like, no. You ran track and you swam, right? She said, yeah, but I wasn't that good. And I said, no, we can teach any idiot how to ride a bike. We want you to be trained for us for the U.S. triathlon. And she was like, nah. And the U.S. had not competed in a triathlon in years. And they convinced her. She trained. She tried out. And she won the gold medal in Rio. And it's like, how do you take your talents? You may not be the best at one thing here or that thing there, but if you frame them in a very specific situation, you're better than anyone in the world. And the trick is you just got to figure out what that is.
Are you the guy that figures out that arrangement then? The U.S. National Committee that was like, you should do this. Like, you have the foresight to see where people could fit in and make this even better.
Yeah, you know, that's actually a really interesting analogy. I was certainly not involved in that decision, but yeah, I guess. In business, they call it being able to see around corners and see what's coming next. And that's probably my biggest strength, other than my just willingness to show up and talk to people and fail miserably and be okay, be totally okay with that, is seeing these people should know this people that should know this people. And there's this kind of project that should come out. And I do that. I've made people millions of dollars throughout my career. And now I've figured out a situation where I can figure out how to monetize that for myself, which affords me opportunity to be able to meet more and more people, that creates other opportunities for me to be able to do nonprofit or pro bono work, or connect XYZ NGO that really needs help with so-and-so architect that's looking to do some really interesting, cool project. And then
that community benefits. And I don't necessarily get paid for that, but that's not what I'm doing it for. It's like I'm doing it to try and do right by people. But yes, so to answer your question, yeah, more or less. That's actually a really good way to put it. I would have never thought. That's funny.
Yeah, very cool. And then I feel like there were so many good like advice for anybody, you know, like fail, be fearless with failing, and then showing up willingly and like doing the hard work. Those are all great.
And being resilient. I mean, like this is coming from a dude that applied to school 4 times before and then they kicked me out twice. And I still managed to graduate. And now they ask me for money and hire your students. It's funny. But like, you got to be willing. If you really want something, go get it. Mm-hmm. Don't bitch and complain and wish that things were different. Make them different.
Yeah. What is that first step that you generally take to just like when you go after something?
I guess it really depends on, for me, I think it would be like some self-reflection about what it is that I want to do, why I want to do it, how I'm going to do it. And then fortunately, I've made a career through whether it's just growing up with people and being authentic my whole life or having a practice where I've hired people and I tell them it's going to be cool and we're going to do this, or this is going to suck for 6 months, but it's going to be amazing after that. I always do everything I can to make those things a reality. So people, it's amazing how rare that is actually that people do that. And it's not that I'm patting myself on the back. It's actually more of a critique on our society. But I've found myself in a situation where people feel like they can trust me and count on me. So if there's an opportunity that I see, I can reach out to people and help connect the dots where, again, where there's no winners and losers, but everybody wins. The client, the design team, the community, the users, every environmental stuff, whatever.
Yeah, that sounds great. I can see that where like when everybody wins, there's no ulterior motives. You don't have to worry. Like second Correct. Guess things, you could just be like, everyone can be fully present in that situation.
Yeah. And again, it's like not, and maybe that's just I don't know. I feel like maybe that's just the region that I grew up in. Architects in general are really supportive of one another. And sometimes like in other markets, like I'm in North Carolina, but other markets, people can be like really like kind of backstabby or get really upset. So-and-so wins a project. Man, if I lose a project to somebody who's really great, good for them. That's awesome. Everybody wins when great architecture gets built. Cool. If I lose to somebody who's going to do a terrible job, that's a gut punch. That's the worst. But for me, it's why does there have to be a winner and loser? It doesn't. And I don't know why we operate that way. And that's just our industry. And it's really a shame. And you could make the same argument for the architect, general contractor, client relationship too. Man, really great buildings have only happened when you've got an incredible team. Like the designer, the architect, the GC, the plumbing engineer, the grading contractor, like everybody's got to be on a great team to make something really amazing happen. And if you have an adversarial relationship, then there is literally no winner in that situation. And, but I find ourselves as an industry in that situation pretty often. Like my buddy, he worked at the same firm since he graduated from college. He worked there for 39 years and he gave that up to come and join me at my practice because I told him it was going to be cool and we were going to do good work and he was going to be valued. And then I left 18 months later. That was a really tough conversation. So anyway.
No, yeah,
sorry.
I'm not like a super
crying person at all. But I do very much wear my emotions on my sleeve. So.
Yeah, no, I think it just goes to show how deeply you value your relationships and the people that put their trust in you. Yeah. No.
Sure.
Yeah. I can cut that out. We can just...
No, whatever you want to do. It doesn't matter to me. Like, okay. Look at William. He's crying on this podcast. I didn't even talk about Jake's grandfather stuff. Like briefly, just for you. I mean, whether you use it for a podcast or not, but like in 2016, I ended up in this really weird situation. There's actually a PBS documentary about it, by the way. Yeah, I ended up in this really weird situation where I got invited to the warehouse of this deceased little known artist. And I looked at, I was like, I don't know, man. I was like, yeah, I like looked at all the stuff online. I'm like, it's not good. I'm super not interested in this. But I got convinced. One of my best friends, first architect I ever worked for, actually, he taught me a lot of the lessons. His name's Craig Bean. He's the one that taught me a lot of the lessons that I try to live by. And he's not a design architect. He's very much a service oriented architect. He's one of the best designers I know. But I mean, it's the type of projects he works on that doesn't necessarily get his chance to show it in the way that architects typically got you. But he's taught me everything about architecture and business. But he was like, oh man, I don't know. I've heard that this guy's work is really great. I was like, okay, oh yeah. And so my ex and my buddy Craig and I, we go to this warehouse and we didn't know what to expect. And we show up and we walk in the door, and then basically there was an artist who had died in a tragic bicycle accident 16 years before. There was a storage warehouse of all his work that his wife tried to find homes for, but it literally was thousands of paintings and drawings, and she just was not capable of doing that. And she had a really bad battle with cancer and just died. And they were going to tear the warehouse down, so they had to get everything out. Not these people, but the people that owned the warehouse storage company were going to tear it down. But so we went to this kind of really cryptic map. It wasn't even on a map. It was like, here's the GPS coordinates. It was kind of sketchy. And we showed up and we walked in this warehouse, and no bullshit. It was like walking into an entirely intact Egyptian tomb with beautiful artifacts laying everywhere. And somebody going, please God, take them, because we don't know what else to do with them. They're going to end up in the trash out of line. And it was Jake's cousins who were in the process of trying to sign homes for their father's work because they didn't have the ability to do so. And it ultimately turned into this really long and elaborate project called the Vernon Pratt Project, where we helped them give paintings away and facilitate the donations of different paintings, and ultimately have been going around giving paintings away to different museums and institutions for the last 8 years now, which is pretty wild. And through that, I've met different museum directors, different curators, just really awesome people, some of the best people I've ever met in the world that I would have never met otherwise. And I should say that we were not interested in taking this whole collection. We helped to facilitate them giving most of it away. But at the very end, his daughter, Jake's cousin, Trinity, started crying, and she was like, I don't know what to do. All of my dad's work's going to end up in the trash. And I just could not bear the thought of somebody else's legacy gone in the trash. And so I told her we would take it and figure out what to do with it. And not because there was any sort of personal gain, but because it was the right thing to do. And that actually is a really interesting, that's kind of how I look at life, with my business, et cetera, and personal relationship. But that's how I met Blake, a really weird thing. And actually, on my LinkedIn page, there's a black and white background, and that's actually a painting that Jake owns that's in Nashville right now. It's one of my favorite paintings that his grandfather ever did. And I should mention that his grandfather was a big deal artist. Like, collaborated with Saul LeWitt, was written up in the New York Times, had a one-man show at North Country DeVar, exhibited all over the world, was the head of art and design at Duke University, and no one has ever heard of him. It's really wild. He died before, like, the internet took off, and he didn't really digitize any of his work. He never sold any of his work because he was doing such paintings of such monumental scale that there's one painting that he did that's 1,534 square feet. It's done in 256 panels. It's a math equation. It's a permutation. And he did it and put it in boxes, and he never actually saw them assembled before he died. And we showed it for the very first time in NC State's Gregg Museum of Art and Design. And that's actually what this PBS documentary is about. It's pretty wild to think about, but it's been a journey. And I think that whole process helped facilitate some of these other things too as well, because I started to see things and how things could come together in unique and totally unexpected ways.
The story is great. And I think at the end, when you were saying how the reason you did this was because you couldn't bear to see the life's work just end up in the trash, that being the core of what you're about, like, that's a great story to describe that.
Sure. Yeah, it's interesting. I'll send you a link to the documentary and to the article about Glenn Jorgensen, because to me, that's like the perfect example of, like, find your, I don't know, the risk of sounding like a motivational speaker superpower or whatever, but find, like, the thing, like, you're good. Everybody is good at one or two things. Like, doesn't matter what it is. Somebody's better, at one thing than anyone else. And it's like, how can you take that and what you enjoy and frame it in a way in which you can do what you can do? I'm really great at helping people grow businesses, win work, try to do better work and build community. That's what I do. So that's why I try to do that for a living.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much for your time. I'll for sure send you those two little links. The documentary is only 16 minutes long.
So perfect.
It's actually really worth seeing. And Jake's seen it. And his grandfather, I think one day will be recognized as in the same glance as Saul DeWitt or Andy Warhol or Jackson Pollock.
Hey, everyone. It's Erin from Out of Architecture. If you find these stories inspiring and are looking for guidance, clarity, or just need someone to talk to about where you are in your career, please know that we offer 30-minute consultations to talk about what may be next for you. If you're interested, head to outofarchitecture.com/scheduling to book some time with us.
Hey, everyone. It's Jake from Out of Architecture. We love hearing your stories, but we know there's more out there that we've still yet to experience. If you or someone you know would be a good fit for the podcast and has a story about taking their architecture skills beyond the bounds of traditional practice, we'd love to hear it. Send us an email at tangents@outofarchitecture.com.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. New episodes every 2 weeks. See you then.